So the aim this morning is to look at the fourth and fifth commandment. The first three commandments we did last week are focused on God, and they began with two negatives, two strong warnings, very sensible ones. Then it ended on a positive note with the third commandment, whereby the Sabbath becomes a positive injunction on the people, a place, a time, a sacred time, a coming together where they can renew their covenant and their relationship with God and keep it on track. We do a similar thing with our Sunday, though it's not quite the same. Now we begin in the commandment four to focus on relationship with others. And it begins with a positive statement, which is symbolic of the lot, really, and starts in the home, which is what we'd expect it to do. And then all the rest of them are negatives. Don't. Good things, negatives, warnings, not to trespass in those areas. But the first one is the fourth commandment, and it reads, "Honour your father and your mother, as the Lord your God commanded you, that your days may be prolonged, and that it may go well with you in the land which the Lord your God gives you." That commandment is repeated in a sense in Paul's letter to the Ephesians. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." The Old Testament, book of Sirach. "With all your heart, honour your father. Do not forget the birth pangs of your mother. Remember that it was your parents who were born. Of your parents you were born. How can you repay what they have given to you?" And in the book of Proverbs, "My child, keep your father's commandment. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. Bind them upon your heart always. Tie them round your neck. When you walk, they will lead you. When you lie down, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk with you." In the fourth commandment, it's not actually directed to little children, primarily. It's directed to us, adults. Our attention moves from ourselves as parents having authority, that's the third commandment, not to have your children or your slaves or anyone working on the Sabbath, to ourselves as children owing obedience. Obedience is a very important concept. Just to watch the word, because it's the same in all these languages, Hebrew, Greek, Latin. It's only in English that it gets a bit wonky. You could think, because words are sometimes abused, that to obey means to do what you're told. That's what I thought it meant years ago. But look at the word carefully. Audiens. Audiens means listening. And ob means close in Latin, right up to, obstruction, right up against. It's a very intimate, close listening. So it's really saying, listen to your parents. The fourth commandment, the Catechism reads, reminds grown children, this is number 2218, of their responsibilities towards their parents. As much as they can, they must give them material and moral support in old age and in times of illness, loneliness, and distress. That's the Catechism, and here's my comment. To honour one's parents is to acknowledge that life is a gift. For a Jew, it's also an acknowledgement that the promises of God and the gift of the law come to us through our parents. To honour one's parents is to be ready to give them back in their need what they gave us in ours. The values inculcated in the family by the third and fourth commandments provide the basis for all the positive values that are to inform human interaction. They direct us to recognize that in all we do, we are instruments of God's creative and redemptive action, and that everything is a gift to be accepted with gratitude and shared in love. If we do this, we will be God's instruments in bringing about the reign of God's love on the earth. The Catechism then goes on to make a few statements. You've got the numbers in front of you there. Sometimes it's a quote, sometimes it's my summary, but it's taken direct from the Catechism. We are to see, quote, in every human person, a son or daughter of the one who wants to be called our Father. This is now extending the commandment from the family, extended family, of course, in their culture and in some of yours, extending that now to the whole of the human race. We're all brothers and sisters. Daily prayer and the reading of the Word of God strengthen the family in charity. You may agree, you may not agree, your family may be different, but it's only in one generation, possibly with the transport and television, maybe two of the major factors, I would think, that have stopped what happened in my childhood, all my childhood. We had the family rosary every night, that's prayer, of course. We also had the Holy Hour once every first Thursday when we read about the Passion of Jesus, and then we went to Mass on Sunday and various other things. But that was kind of taken for granted in my home, and I'm only 70, so we're not, you know, I'm not, it's within living memory. So, but in my brother's home, my eldest brother and his wife always said the rosary. Did they have the rosary with their kids? I don't think so. Did they have any other prayer with their kids except grace before and after meals? I'm not sure. And similarly with my other two brothers and my sister, you know, in our generation, family prayer has taken a bit of a battering because the kids are never there, and there's movement, and there's action, and there's sport, and there's travel, and there's cars. We didn't have a car, and all those things, and so on. We have to recapture it. We have to do something, because if the faith is not nurtured in a little child's heart and in a teenager's heart in the home, it won't be nurtured anywhere else. The school cannot do what the home doesn't do. It's meant to, that's true, isn't it? I mean, it supports the home, but if it's not happening at home, please don't expect the teachers to be able to do it. And most of them are from homes that don't do it anyhow, perhaps. So we're talking about something really critical here. Again, the Catechism goes on. Parents should associate their children from their tenderest years with the life of the church. A wholesome family life can foster interior dispositions that are a genuine preparation for a living faith and remain a support to it throughout one's life. As a priest, you see this so clearly. Of course, you don't see the complications of home life. And if any parent ever brings a child to church, I feel like canonising them because I've got a bit of an idea what might be going on to get them there. But it's just like this wonderful stuff is going on. But when you see mum there with a little child getting ready for First Communion and dad not there because he's busy, it's very sad. I'm feeling sad, I mean, because the mother's enjoying this little child growing and nurturing and dad's not enjoying it. And I think, why is he missing out on all this? What a tragedy that this is more important probably than anything else he could do. And it's usually that way, mum's there and dad's not. Remember this little girl came up to me one day, I've said this before I think, because I'll never forget it, after Mass, because our little children, when they come, and perhaps in your church, do we give them a blessing with the host before they receive communion, because they're not up to that age yet. And this little girl came up to me one day, and I've given you the answer, but I was too thick-headed. She said, only four more blessings. And I thought, four more blessings? I've already given her one. What's she want four more for? You see, male. But mum was there, and she kind of, so I picked up what that meant. This little child was counting down the blessings to First Communion. And she was jumping out of her skin. She could hardly wait. So I said, oh, I made sure she came down the aisle where I was. See, priests are a bit greedy like that. I wanted her to be there to receive it from me because she was so excited about it. And the dear little thing did, and then she became an altar server and the rest of it. But Mum was there enjoying all this, you know, something burgeoning in the little girl's life and eyes and heart. And Dad was not there. So it's very, yeah. The catechism goes on, the parish is the Eucharistic community and the heart of the liturgical life of Christian families. It's a privileged place for the catechesis of children and parents. Number 2232, the catechism. Family ties are important, and this is a bit what we were saying earlier, but they're not absolute. Just as the child grows to maturity and human and spiritual autonomy, so the child's unique vocation, which comes from God, asserts itself more clearly and forcefully. Parents should respect this call and encourage their children to follow it. We've had examples over the years in the RCIA, the Rite of Christian Initiation of Adults, and in the Catholics Returning Home program, both of which happen in our parish. We've had a number of examples of parents dragged there by their kids and enjoying to be there. It's their little child's opening faith that has helped the parent stop being too busy and come back to something more radical. It's wonderful to see. They must be, the catechism continues, convinced that the first vocation of the Christian is to follow Jesus. And here's Jesus, Matthew 10, if you love father or mother more than me, you're not worthy of me. Just in English, that could sound bizarre. But you see what Jesus is saying? If your father and mother are your first love, if your husband and wife is your first love, you won't be loving them very well. The love you have for your husband, wife, family, parents, friends, comes from God. So it's the communion in your own heart with the mystery that is God, the Father, the Mother, God. That's at the core of everything. And if that's calling you on, your mother and father will be loved a million times more than if that's not there. And your children will be, and your brothers and sisters will be. You follow what I'm trying to say. There's something radical and focused that actually it's from that well of communion with God that all love springs. So that has to be first. Seek first the kingdom and everything else will come. And just to complete the fourth commandment, the catechism now talks about the family and society, because the family is the unit of society. And in number 2209, the catechism reads, the family must be helped and defended by appropriate social measures. Where families cannot fulfill their responsibilities, other social bodies have the duty of helping them and supporting the institution of the family. Following the principle of subsidiarity, larger communities should take care not to usurp the family's prerogatives or interfere in its life. Subsidiarity is one of the basic principles of moral theology. The larger body does not do what the smaller body can do. So the family comes first, and only when the family needs assistance do others come in to assist, but not to take over. Number 2236 reads, those in authority should practice distributive justice wisely, taking account of the needs and contribution of each with a view to harmony and peace. And number 2211, ways in which the political community must support the family I'll leave that for you to read for yourself, but it makes suggestions as to how the political community can help the family. And all our political parties want to do that, and the last one and the present one, they're trying to do it as best they can in a complicated economy, but they need to do it. They must do it. Goes on to talk about obedience to civil authority. And there are the numbers there, 2240 reads, submission to authority and co-responsibility for the common good make it morally obligatory to pay taxes, to exercise the right to vote, and to defend one's country. But 2242 reads, the citizen is obliged in conscience not to follow the directives of civil authorities when they are contrary to the demands of the moral order, to the fundamental rights of persons, or the teachings of the gospel. Now, it may be, I'll just say a guess here, it may be that in our country it doesn't often bring a conflict, but you know some countries and some periods of history where people's life, the life of their wife and their family, utterly depended on their obeying an immoral order. Nazi Germany is a standout example, but there's plenty of others. So I'd be the last to judge the person in that situation, but the heroism required of some people to say, no, I won't, and to lose their own life, or to wonder what's going to happen to their kids at home, is immense, isn't it? I've never been in that situation, but wow, the heroes can do it, most can't. Hence the phenomena that we see of people obeying orders that they should not be obeying and giving power to corrupt authority, which can then continue the corruption. So the moral obligation is clear. Carrying out could require absolutely heroic virtue. My comment then is, obedience to authority does not mean that we must simply obey whatever those in political authority command. There can even be a place for armed resistance to oppression by political authority. However, this requires stringent conditions, and these are laid out in the Catechism. So if I or you or we are going to use violent methods to oppose a violent, corrupt order from civil authority, then this is the long tradition of the requirements that must be there. I think they're wise. Not everyone's capable of living the Beatitudes, and we're not asking the whole community to be saints. In the real world, realpolitik, maybe, it seems to me, the Catechism says, these are the conditions for using force against force when the force is corrupt against you. One, there is a certain, it's not obscure, grave, serious, and prolonged violation of fundamental rights. Not just a moment, but it's prolonged, it's endemic, it's right in the system, and you stare at it and that's what's happening. Second, all other means of redress have been exhausted. Very hard to work these out in the real world, but we're looking at principles that we need to have in mind as best we may. So you've tried everything else, but nothing's working. The oppression is continuing. Such resistance will not provoke worse disorders. You have to think that through. If we rise up against a corrupt political authority, we may end up causing more and more trouble to more and more people. We may. So we've got to weigh that as well. Fourth, there's a well-founded hope of success. Otherwise, what's the point of doing it? You're just wiping everybody else out. Somebody like me or anybody gets up on a thing and yells out to everybody, revolt, 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 and then I go home and watch the television, you all revolt and get killed. What the heck have I done? Nothing's gained. And good people have kind of got caught up in an emotion that hasn't worked. And finally, it's impossible reasonably to foresee any better solution. So we're talking about a last resort thing. think it through, and we might want to talk about it next week or disagree with it. And to conclude, the fourth commandment, this is my comment for what it's worth. One way of expressing this is to say that there are always limits to the duty of obedience. Always. Another, and perhaps a better way, is to draw attention to the primary meaning of obedience which I've given you earlier. The word doesn't convey the idea of doing what you're told, though we would be wise to do so when our own judgment is poor and when we're being directed by those with more wisdom than us, especially when they speak in love. The word obedience derives from the Latin audiens, listening, so present participle, active listening, with the adverbial prefix ob, meaning right up close. To obey, then, is to listen attentively from an intimate contact with the situation and with the one issuing the command. Having listened attentively, one retains the obligation to make a conscientious decision. Often this will mean tuning one's will to that of the person exercising authority. Sometimes it will mean deciding to follow a path that differs from the one in which others are directing us. This is relative to the level of the person's authority. Maturity, thank you. So that's my summary of it. I hope it makes some sense to you. I've had to do that. I'm sure you've all had to do that. Sometimes you have to say, no, I won't. Because you can't, and it's wrong from your perspective to do it. But if you say, no, I won't, having listened and having communicated as one adult to another, honestly as you can, nearly always that will be respected by the other person because they see that you're not just going off on your own, you're actually making a conscientious decision. And in the church's teaching, conscience is the fundamental arbiter of everything. You have to be yourself, you have to follow your conscience, and I cannot force your conscience, nor should I ever try to. So if I am in authority and I give you a command and you say, I can't do it and I won't do it, but you've listened and we've debated it, I hope I step back in respect for what you've decided to do.